two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, are you ready to add a sprinkle of joy to your day? Then you need to check out Add to Cart. Hi, I'm Sujan Pak.
And I'm Kulap Vilaysack. We're your hosts, and on this show, we talk about the things we buy, the things we buy into, and what it says about who we are.
That's right. Each week, we're going to have some honest and maybe, you know, a little TMI conversations about all the fabulous, weird, wonderful things we're adding to or ditching from our carts. You know, we talk about beauty products, latest health trends, philosophies we're passionate about. Nothing is off limits on this podcast.
We're diving deep into everything we and our guests buy into and exploring what it reveals about who we truly are. We're going to decide what's worth the investment, be it money or emotions.
Add to Cart from Lemonada Media has new episodes out on Tuesdays, wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
Welcome to In the Bubble. This is Andy Slavitt. It is Monday, June 13th. Hope everyone had a good weekend. We have a great show today, a really great show today, as a matter of fact. Had some fun episodes last week, had a really good serious conversation on Friday, but today we have Larry Summers, who was the Secretary of Treasury and the head of the National Economic Council, but he's been in the news a lot lately because he was pretty outspoken last year in saying that inflation is going to be a big problem in the U.S. economy. And he got a lot of pushback, including from the White House, current Secretary Janet Yellen, who said, no, it's only temporary. And as it turns out, Summers was right. And so he's getting a lot of attention. And I thought we'd have him on the show. You know, he talks a lot to places like the Wall Street Journal about some of the big things that are going to happen macro in the economy. But I thought it would be really great if he would come on and talk about what he thinks is going to happen, but also break it down into some very specifics about how it's going to impact people. So what's going to happen with mortgage rates? What's likely to happen in the job market? What's likely to happen to gas prices? What's likely to happen to home prices? What's likely to happen to your 401k? And to be as specific as possible, because he's got a reputation for being willing to make these predictions. And he does on this show, and he does this episode, and I really appreciated that. This is a really timely conversation. It's in advance of tomorrow's and Wednesday's Federal Open Market Committee meeting, where we're going to learn about what's going to happen further with interest rates. I think we know that they're going to be heading up. But what's that going to mean? You know, to fight inflation, the Fed only has a limited number of tools. Larry's going to talk about that. And the consequences of fighting inflation, the consequence of using those tools is going to be to make interest rates go up. It's going to be to reduce jobs in the economy. And I ask Larry point blank whether or not we're out to see stagflation. Stagflation, in a sense, the classic definition, is just the economy is not growing, it's shrinking, and we still have inflation. And I think it's really important that you hear the answer. Now, you'll notice in this show that I refer to him as Mr. Secretary, and I just want to explain this. Before we get on every interview, every single guest, I ask them, how would you like to be referred? We have a lot of doctors. We have a lot of scientists. There's a lot of people. Usually I call them by their first name because we're casual. Under normal circumstances, I would be calling him Larry. But I said to him before the show, hey, I'm going to call you Mr. Secretary. Is that okay? He said, yeah, that's fine. If you call me Larry, that's fine too. But if it sounds a little strange to you, it sounds a little awkward, that's why. And I do that to just put guests in the frame of mind, all guests, where they know they're being respected. You know, these are achievements. And so I don't like to get too formal. I like to keep it casual, but I think I find other ways to try to get him to get to some very relatable points. And I think he does a really good job of this. So I'm proud of this episode. I think it's one of our best ones. Not that, you know, being in the cockpit with Jay Ellis is anything to sneeze at. And look, if you didn't listen to that episode, you might want to go back because you missed a good one. But this is great. So we're going to welcome Larry Summers, and we're going to talk about what's next in the economy. Well, welcome to the bubble, Mr. Secretary. So I'm wondering if you could just start by giving listeners a recap of kind of where we are in the economy and how we got to this point. When did we start to see inflation rise, and what were the driving factors?
We're in an economy that is overheated. That's got very important positives. We've got very, very low unemployment. We've seen compression in wages as lower income people have seen their wages go up faster than higher income people. We've seen rapid growth in employment. But it also comes with higher inflation that erodes real wages and an underlying rate of inflation that is far too high, driven fundamentally by the fact that we've got more demand than supply. And when you've got more demand than supply, prices go up. There's lots of room for argument about just how much of it is more demand, just how much of it is less supply. Economists argue a lot about it, but I think it's very hard to escape the conclusion that we've got too much demand relative to supply. And so the challenge now is to get demand and supply back into balance. But the reality is that there's not that much we can do that influences supply in the short run. And so the dominant determinant of what happens is likely to be demand. And we've got too much of it right now. And the challenge is to achieve the proverbial soft landing. And the painful lesson of history is that most landings, when you're flying this high, don't turn out to be soft.
There's kind of a thud. I mean, we've experienced for the last number of decades, certainly with the exception of some recessions, an economy that grew but never grew so fast as it impacted inflation. Clearly something changed, and clearly there were many others who had gotten lulled into a sense that that's just something that could just keep on going. And so if you get behind what has changed, and obviously we had, you know, a pandemic, there's a war in an oil-producing country. China's in a weird situation. I remember when I worked in the Obama administration for Secretary Burwell, she used to require us, if we said, hey, there's a few factors here, she'd say, hey, Slavitt, draw a pie chart. What percentage of the factors would you allocate to each of these different causes? She's trying to get me to be a little more disciplined in my thinking. If you were kind of thinking about supply factors and demand factors, and then also, I guess I'd say, you've been critical of kind of policy judgments, whether it's on the Fed side, Congress and the administration with the Rescue Act. Like, do you have a mental model of how you apportion what the principal drivers are in your view?
I think it's pretty clear that we had very substantial demand problems before we had the Ukraine war. And I think it's pretty clear that we substantially increased demand with the policies that were pursued in 2021. The judgment made to commit almost 14% of GDP in budget stimulus measures, the judgment of the Fed, even while we were having this massive fiscal expansion, to step on the accelerator with monetary policy with zero interest rates and very substantial quantitative easing policies where the government was growing its balance sheet. And so those two things together really were important causes of a big increase in demand. If If you look at many of the things where people talk about bottlenecks, semiconductors, for example, the quantity sold was actually greater in 2021 than it had been before, which is kind of what tells you that it's a demand increase. But there's no question that this has all been made substantially worse by what's happened in oil markets, which is related to the Ukraine war, by what's happened to food prices that was starting to develop even before the Ukraine war, and that we hit some bottlenecks last year. So I think it's best to think of it as a mixture of demand and supply factors. But I think there's got to be a major role of demand. And I think the last thing I would say is when you have a flat tire, you don't fix it by blowing air in where the leak was. And in the same way, we can't really do that much about supply.
Right.
And so the tool that we have at our disposal is the use of demand.
Yeah, that was really where I was going with the question, which is one problem harder than the other to solve? Are we in a situation where because of supply issues will continue to cause price pressure and inflation, and the Fed will take action to try to slow the economy down on the demand side, but we could end up with still high prices, but a recession, i.e. something that looks more like stagflation?
I think the tendency is likely to be towards stagflation. In general, when the Fed pursues restrictive policies, it influences the level of employment, the level of GDP, before it influences the level of inflation. And even that takes time. So my best guess would be that we're headed in for a period that's going to be painful on both metrics, both on unemployment and on inflation. I think inflation's likely to come down from some of the levels we've seen in the last few months, but I don't think it's going to come down to the point where it's not a major problem. And I do think that we're likely sometime in the next 18 months or 2 years to see a significant increase in unemployment.
Interesting kind of conversation around wages, and I'm hoping you can help unpack it for people. There's a lot of people in the economy that would say, well, you know, we haven't had a living wage or prevailing wage. And so even before inflation, there was hope that there'd be some upward pressure on wages. And of course, now that people are seeing inflation, there's even greater demand. And when it moves into what I think you economists refer to as a wage price cycle, where you say, hey, wait a minute, it's costing me more to live. I've got to go ask my employer for more money. That then increases the cost of goods and services, because so much of goods and services, certainly services, but even goods, are labor-based. And so how should people think about the role of wages here and what this will likely mean for the outcome on wages?
You know, every numerator requires a denominator. And when you see what happens to somebody's dollar wages, you have to look at the prices they're paying to know what that means. And the experience in the United States has generally been that when wage inflation, growth in wages, gets above about 4%, the purchasing power of wages tends to be going down rather than going up. Mm. And the faster you get the inflation going, the more you see declines in the purchasing power of wages. And so as a general rule, inflation doesn't tend to be great for the purchasing power of working people. And that's why, in service of higher purchasing power, I think it's important that we work to contain inflation.
Yeah, that is interesting, and it's probably counterintuitive at the individual level, where people feel like, hey, if I get this raise, it's going to be permanent. Maybe now's the time in a hot economy to negotiate for a different job and get a better income, and at least that'll keep it higher. But the point I think you're reminding us is that when that happens, we're not catching up. It's of course very unevenly distributed, so there's probably winners and losers.
The classic example is that if one person stands up at a ball game, they see better. If everyone stands up at the ball game, nobody sees much better, and everybody's less comfortable.
Man, that feels like an analogy around so many parts of the pandemic, Mr. Secretary, that I wish I'd used. By the way, you've given me like five things I wish I'd have said to Burwell back when I was working for her, when she was making me answer questions that I didn't really know the answer to. When you remind us, so you said we were at zero, in fact, we were at zero interest rate in interest rates for a long time, and arguably with some of the purchasing, even in some respects, negative interest rates. Remind us where we are now and how high you think things will need to go before the Fed says, kind of, we've done as much of this job as we're going to do, and how long do you think it should take them to get there?
You know, it's very hard to know. I think the markets and the Fed are sort of expecting that we'll get interest rates up sometime early next year to the 2.5% to 3% range. And people are hoping that that's going to be enough to contain inflation. It might be, but I rather doubt it.
And by 2 to 3%, you're referring to the Fed funds rate?
The Fed funds rate, yes.
Okay,
the
got it.
Basic short-term interest rate that the Fed loans money to banks at. But I think that the experience is that usually you have to raise interest rates by more than the inflation you're trying to stop if you want to contain inflation. And so if we're trying to stop an inflation that's at 4 or 5%, even if it comes down a little bit, I think it's quite doubtful whether 3% interest rates will be enough to do it.
And where are we today? Do you remind us what the Fed funds rate?
Today, we're less than 1%, but we're coming up fast. We're coming up. People expect that in early June, we're going to come up by 50 basis points. And then in mid-July, we're going to come up by another 50 basis points.
So that they come to 1.5 to 2, and you could see this continuing to get up to 3 or 4, which would take us into 2023. It sounds
right.
Like
I don't think people, I think in general, markets and people are not really expecting 3 to 4.
Okay.
They're expecting more like 2.5 to 3. I think that there's a good, very good chance that it'll be necessary to get to 4 or higher.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Welcome to The Dough, where cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together because, y'all, Season 2 is here. Hosted every week by me, X-Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season 2 of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to talk about what that looks like and feels like to the public. And I, you know, reminds me, I mean, I'm old enough to have experienced the 1970s and inflation and various economies, you know, throughout the decades. I recognize that not everybody listening to this is. And so it's a strange thing to explain to people. So I was thinking it might be interesting to talk about the impact on five or six things that are real things in people's lives. And I'll mention what they are, and then maybe we could tick through them very quickly, and about how we could see these things changing for Americans over the next, you know, year, year and a half, 2 years, is what you predict or are suggesting is possible goes through. And those are, number one, gas and food prices. Number two, the job market. Number three, housing prices. Number four, mortgage rates. And number five, 401ks.
Yeah, sure. Look, gas prices are already pretty high. Hard to know. My guess is they're probably going to go a little higher given all the strains associated with the Ukraine war. That's got more to do with what's happening in geopolitics, frankly, than it does with respect to inflation. Same is true for some parts of food prices because of the terrible restrictions that are going to have far graver consequences for poor people all over the world from the embargo that's being placed on the ability to export Ukrainian wheat.
Grain. Yeah, wheat. Should people have in their head then that with unless there's relief in the war in Ukraine, we will still continue to see high gas and food prices?
I don't think without a resolution there, you're going to get a return to normal in either gas or food prices.
And I'm sure this is very hard to predict, but if you did somehow see a negotiated, some sort of end to the war, markets would clearly rally, I would imagine. But would you expect that to translate into, you know, improved outlook and supply for food and fuel?
I think that would be the most likely. I think that would be the most likely thing. I think the history is that when you place sanctions on countries, the sanctions tend to stay for a long time. So I'm not sure you're going to see sanctions on Russian oil being released anytime real soon.
I see. That's helpful. That's helpful information. The second one I was asking about would be jobs. The job market. Right now, the economy is still adding a few hundred thousand jobs. People are entering the workforce. Employees are kings and queens, if you will, at least to a greater extent than they've been from a long time in terms of some highly competitive fields, being able to ask for wage increases, et cetera. But tell me what that outlook looks like over the next couple of years as the Fed continues to raise interest rates.
My guess is that we'll continue to see job growth for the next few months. Beyond that, I think the picture is much murkier. And I'd be quite surprised if the kind of 400,000 jobs a month that we've been seeing for the last period is something that would continue for another year or two. I'd expect a very sharp slowdown in the rate of job growth. And I think at some point in the next couple of years, we're likely to have months when we're losing jobs rather than gaining jobs.
So the periods of time when people really have to worry about keeping their jobs and unemployment going up is you tend to be recessionary periods where people start to cut or they find new efficiencies with technology, et cetera. Is that something that you think people should be particularly worried about around the corner?
It's a basic fact about the U.S. economy, and there's a similar fact about other major economies, that when unemployment is above four and below four and inflation is above four, almost always within the next 2 years, you have a recession.
Got it. So the greatest asset that people have, the most valuable asset that many people have is their home. And, you know, there's been, you know, with some interruptions, there's been a boom in the value of people's houses. And a lot of people, my mother-in-law, my mom to a certain extent, you know, a lot of their retirement and a lot of people who are retiring is to some degree based upon the perceived equity value in their home. Many people have paid off their mortgages. And then, of course, you got other people that have, you know, that have sort of bought expensive new homes when interest rates were low, and then maybe they've stretched. And so this could be a cause of real stress and real strain on families. It's also just an important asset. How should people be thinking in general about the value of their homes?
No one knows. My bet would be that home prices will continue to rise, at least for some interval, but much less rapidly than they have been rising. I think that the very high increase in mortgage rates is likely to slow the growth in housing prices, and we're not likely to see further years of 20 or 25% growth in housing prices. But again, nobody knows for sure how this is going to play out. But my instinct would be that almost certainly we'll see some leveling in the growth of housing prices.
How high will mortgage rates get? I think when people think about interest rates, most people don't have to deal with the Fed funds rate unless they're reading the Wall Street Journal, in which they kind of understand it as a benchmark. So, you know, it tends to probably either be the mortgage they pay, or if they've got a portfolio, a retirement portfolio, you know, maybe they've invested in corporate bonds or government bonds or municipal bonds of some sort. But the primary factor, as you point out, for a lot of this demand seems to be have been low interest rates. Where do mortgage rates seem to be headed?
Mortgage rates right now are in the low fives. Who knows? Again, but I think I wouldn't be surprised if sometime in the next year or two we saw mortgage rates with a six as the first digit.
Okay. So what I'm hearing you say, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I want to recap to make sure I understand it, that housing prices may not rise as fast, but I didn't hear you say that you anticipate that they would fall or lose a lot of value necessarily. I know you're not making any guarantees, but for just general kind of framework, and that mortgage rates have some upward trajectory. But what I didn't hear you say were the kind of numbers we saw in the 1980s, 8%, 9%, 10%.
That doesn't seem to me to be an immediate prospect, no. Never say never with respect to anything, but I don't think that the kind of 13% mortgage rates that were prevailing when I bought my first house in 1982 are a terribly likely prospect going forward.
And then the last factor that I'm thinking about that really impacts people is their 401k, or if they've invested individually in assets or investments, but for many people.
I'm not going to answer that question, because I think the one thing that's very clear is that unless you're an extremely seasoned professional, mm-hmm. you're better off as an investor setting a portfolio and sticking with it rather than trying to guess what's going to happen and timing the market every month or two. And so I don't want to do anything that will encourage your listeners to be trying their hand at market timing.
I hope my 20-year-old with a Robinhood account is listening, because I think he believes he's had a God-given right to buy a stock, whatever it is, and look at it 3 weeks later and have it be higher than the $50 he paid for it. And indeed, while I'm joking, there is a little bit of, I don't want to say an entitlement element to the economy, but a sense that, well, things are always going to go up, and therefore, you know, and that's what people are generally told, put away money early, sock it away. But what you're saying is we can't predict and time the market, and that if you've got money in your 401k, the same things that cause you to invest in it are the same factors that you drive today, and there's going to be ups and downs.
I think something like that would be right. The main point is, don't buy because you wish you'd bought yesterday. Don't sell because you wish you'd sold yesterday. The great source of financial error is doing today what you wish you had done yesterday.
Well, I know I'm going to buy crypto because some actor or athlete told me that they don't understand it, but I'm an idiot if I don't invest in it.
That would be a bad reason to buy crypto.
I think like all of the crypto ads are basically like put out by the people who, they're like targeting the people who in high school did whatever the popular kids told them to do or dared them to do without understanding why.
I think that people need to be very careful about letting their emotions be swayed as they're making investment decisions.
So first of all, thank you for taking people through those impacts. I think they were very helpful and very grounding and very real. I've been interested, like, at how people like Jeff Bezos, Jamie Dimon, and Elon Musk have all kind of come out with these sort of pronouncements. And I don't know if they're right or wrong. I'm not sure what data they're backed by. And look, I don't think the three of them have equal levels of opinion. Jamie Dimon obviously has lots of resources at his disposal to do financial analysis. But I noticed that he anticipated what he called an economic hurricane coming our way. Do you know what he means by that? Do any of these comments have some sort of resonance?
Economic hurricane is not a technical term in the jargon of economics. I think they're expressing, each in their own way, what is a concern that I expressed a little bit earlier in this conversation, that history suggests that when you start at moments like this, there's a substantial risk that at some point in the next couple of years, you're going to have a recession. And I think that is a risk we all have to face.
Am I reading between the lines too much to say that, as I heard you talk through what you think some of the impacts on the economy are, that you're not necessarily predicting a kind of great recession type recession of 2008, 2009, 2010?
You know, I think we've had many recessions, and I think many people tend to gravitate to focusing on the last two, to focusing on the one when the pandemic started, right, and focusing on the great financial crisis. And I don't think either of those are necessarily the right paradigm for thinking about the next recession. We've had other recessions, like the one we had when the tech bubble burst in the year 2000 or late in 2001, or the recession that took place when the first President Bush was president, that came out of a variety of imbalances in the economy. Those are also recessions. They're painful, but they're not the kind of catastrophic, jarring experience that the great financial crisis was. They're fairly blurry in most people's memories for that reason. And my own best guess would be that if and when the economy has its next recession, and we surely haven't seen the last recession, that the likelihood would be as I describe it. We would not necessarily have the kind of maximally severe recession that we suffered on the two most recent occasions.
Hi, I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jessica St. Clair.
And each week we are sitting down to talk all about life's twists, turns, and absurdities on The Deep Dive.
From exploring the depths of TikTok, which is our only news source, to navigating the complexities of grief and loss, we are just two best friends behind a mic processing life together.
This podcast is all about finding the silver linings in the madness. So get ready for unfiltered conversations about motherhood, careers, pop culture, and everything in between.
Here at The Deep Dive, we're all about community. We believe in the power of sharing experiences and the strength that comes from supporting one another. And we would love to have you with us.
So be sure to join us every Wednesday on The Deep Dive from Lemonada Media, wherever you get your podcasts.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, you mentioned the pandemic just now. I'm curious, Mr. Secretary, if you have thoughts about the pandemic and how that's kind of impacted things.
I've spent a lot of time thinking about the pandemic, thinking about the pandemic in terms of its impacts on the economy, but thinking of its impacts more broadly. 1 million people have died. That's more than the number who died, any died since the Civil War in all the conflicts that we have had. If you attempt to put a dollar value on the loss of life, on the pain and suffering, on the disruption from the pandemic, it is very comfortably in the many trillions of dollars. I can't help but think that if we were able to avert even a very small fraction of that, or we were able to make it less likely that there would be a recurrence, that that would be money extraordinarily well spent. And so I am very concerned that we are not making what are probably the highest return investments that our country could make in better screening, in the development of new and better vaccines and tests, in their pervasive distribution, and in forward defense of our country by supporting the anti-COVID effort around the world. You know, virus anywhere is a threat in a Darwinian world to people everywhere. And I think historians will look back and they will not be able to understand how it is that a country with a annual budget between $3 and $4 trillion a year could not afford, in the year we crossed our millionth death, to spend a few billion dollars saving life and preventing suffering here in the United States and around the world. Yes, there are huge issues about what attitude we should have towards vaccination, and I, of course, am for vaccines. Yes, there are people who have turned masking into a kind of social test of concern rather than a public health measure. But whether you are a progressive or a conservative, whether you are a public health specialist or an epidemiologist, there are ways we can spend money that will have immense returns in saving life, immense returns in being in enabling children to be able to go to school, immense returns in terms of being us all being able to safely enjoy events with large numbers of our fellow citizens, spending money in ways that will build goodwill for the United States around the world at a time when we're in existential competition. And it is madness that we are not spending billions directed at a problem that is measured in the trillions. And that is not something that you should blame one person or one group for. But I think all of us should be soul-searching on why we can't find our way to a solution.
Look, that was both a very passionate and a very articulate and a very credible, balanced read of situation that I think that most of our listeners know we face right now, which is there's $22 billion request in front of Congress, and that the current state of affairs is if we do end up simply with a new vaccine in the fall, which is just a high likelihood that we'll have a bivalent vaccine that's more effective against Omicron, that we don't have the ability to pay for the vaccine for everybody in this country. And of course, the idea that we would have a vaccine, but have many people not be able to afford to take it, you know, on top of other reasons why people aren't getting vaccinated, you know, to me, this is your stadium point on steroids. So
if we can spend $40 billion on Ukraine, why can't we spend 10 on vaccinating, screening, testing, protecting the health of Americans?
How adamant would you be that it be fully paid for versus not in this environment?
I couldn't care less whether it was fully paid for or not. There are general budget principles that should govern all that, but $10 or $15 billion is not that much money. And if we do it, and that $10 billion saves the economy $50 billion, it will pay for itself a number of times over. So I'm happy paying for it. I'd be willing to not pay for it. But for God's sake, battling around about whether we're going to pay for it or whether we're not going to pay for it has got to make no sense relative to not doing the investment.
Well, I think I heard you say that this is the highest return investment we could possibly make as a country right now, simply from an economic standpoint, let alone all the other reasons you gave. The question that I think a lot of Americans have is, you know, are there structural issues or structural things about the economy that have happened over the last few years that are causing us to be in the situation we're in and ought to be addressed now? And I'll give you a pick of the litter, and you could pick the ones that you want to comment on. But, you know, we used to be in a climate when you were Treasury Secretary where anything you put in front of the Congress, you had something called PAYGO. You had to make sure you were paying for it. That seemed to go away. I don't know exactly when it went away. Maybe it went away in the Trump years. Maybe it was before. It seems that the pandemic was an excuse for it to go away. And, of course, Congress loves spending money without paying for it. I don't care which party they're in. I tell Paul Ryan that all the time. Tax rates, an issue, you know, corporate tax rates and progressive tax rates, income inequality and the safety net, you know, trade issues, kind of the dependence we have on foreign countries and for low cost goods, antitrust issues. I know there's a whole array. You could probably write a treatise on each one of these things. So I'd give you your choice in the time we have. You know, are there things that are structural in the economy that are really showing themselves here to be real problems?
Andy, I have tried to discipline myself to never use the word structural, because I think when people talk about structural policies or structural problems or structural anything, everybody's eyes glaze over and they think it's another guy from the government going blah, 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 blah again. So I'm going to try not to use the word structural. But I'll tell you some things that I believe. We've got an extraordinary infrastructure deficit in our country. I've been flying from Boston to Washington for 45 years. It used to take an hour and a quarter. Now it takes an hour and 45 minutes. The planes haven't gotten slower. The airports haven't gotten further apart. That is all about core infrastructure. In Massachusetts, we bear a cost equal to a 75-cent a gallon gas tax in extra repairs on our cars because of potholes in the roads, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers. I'm lucky enough to travel around the world. The phone service between Alma Ata Airport and the center of Alma Ata in Kazakhstan and my office in Boston works better than on the Dulles Toll Road, driving in to our nation's capital. Those are crazy gaps. And in a world of 1%, 2%, even 3% interest rates in a currency we print ourselves, it is crazy that we are not fixing those things and making those investments. We have an education system where there is something we lead the world in among our kids, and that is self-esteem. Our kids think they're better at math than kids anywhere else in the world think they're good at math. The only problem is they're actually very mediocre, actually, by international standards. We need an educational system that does what gets done in what you do or what I do. The people who teach the best should get rewarded the most, not simply get paid on a union set seniority scale. The customers, family, and parents should get some choice if they don't like the product they're getting. That's why appropriately designed charter schools are so profoundly important. And we need to celebrate excellence again in education. That's what built this country, and we are lagging. Call it education, call it human capital, call it whatever you want, but we can do a lot better than we are doing as a country. And the third example I would mention is our innovation policies and our support for science and technology. In many ways, we are a remarkable success story. If you think about all the great technology companies, all the great information technologies, almost all of them were incubated in the United States and built out of the United States. It is a huge strength to be the only free country where you can raise your first $100 million before you buy your first suit. That is a profoundly positive thing. But it rests on a broad innovation system. Depends upon the quality of our science and mathematics education, which all too often has become politicized and is lacking. It depends also on how the government allocates money. You know, the National Institute of Health did not fund mRNA. It did not fund CRISPR. Those are the two most fundamental technologies of life sciences in the last 20 years. They were funded out of the Defense Department through DARPA. We've got to learn the lessons of those successes and find much more flexible and effective ways of funding. We need to set high sights as a country, and we need, and this is particularly the challenge for progressives like you and me, we need to show that government can do things and can do things effectively. Nobody's boss gives them new responsibilities until they prove that they're totally in control of the responsibilities they already have. And until government gets better at some of the core tasks that it has, I think progressives are making a mistake to try to ever widen the ambit of responsibility of government. So there is a lot we can do to build a stronger foundation. I think that it's America's history that when people are most afraid, that's when we have the most prophecies of doom. And those prophecies prove self-denying, and the best days lie in the future. And I dare to hope that that will be true again.
You know, this, you do not sound pessimistic to me about this country. You do not sound pessimistic to me about this future. You don't even sound particularly pessimistic about the near term, relative to, I think, what I do perceive to be this sense that when things are good, No one wants to hear bad news. And then, so they have a tough time accepting that, that things might be changing for the worse. And then when things do, of course, start to change for the worse, people then flip to the other side and say, well, things are never going to get better. Things are going downhill. And whether it's climate policy, whether it's healthcare policy, whether it's education policy, all these things need investment. And what I hear you saying is we can afford, we have to be able to afford, and we have the capability to afford to be able to invest in these things and make our country better. And then I also heard you just say at the very end there that the issue isn't so much being able to afford it, it's showing we can execute it and showing the country that they should have faith in government to execute it, and that is a bigger issue.
I think that's exact. I think that is exactly right, particularly, Andy, in your emphasis on execution. Winston Churchill never said, but it was a true statement, that you can always count on the United States, always count on the United States, to do the right thing, but only after it exhausts the alternatives. But I think that captures a fundamental truth. I think, and I hope, and I trust that we will again see the power of self-denying prophecy, and that all of the pessimists will again be proven wrong.
Thank you, and I know this is very much appreciated by everybody listening in, and by me as well, so hopefully we'll have you back sometime.
Thank you.
Let me tell you what's coming up on In the Bubble. Wednesday's show, we've got an array of COVID news. We've got some insights into what the next set of vaccines are going to look like. We've got a new vaccine approved. Later on this month, we've got some other great shows. Adam Conover, who you might know from Adam Ruins Everything, has got a new show on Netflix about the government. We're going to talk to him. Beto O'Rourke is coming on. He's going to talk about what's going on in Texas after the shooting and the role that he's playing. Very interesting, as always. Jason Kander, who you might know, was at one time talked about as a presidential candidate, and his political career took a turn in a different direction when he talked about publicly having PTSD and that kind of blend of what post-traumatic stress disorder and a high public profile and how that came together is an amazing story, and he's a really interesting person. Lots of other good things, including, of course, our Friday conversations coming up on Friday, so please stick with us, and more importantly, enjoy the rest of the day, and we'll be talking to you on Wednesday. Thank you for listening to In the Bubble. We're a production of Lemonada Media. Catherine Barnes, Jackie Harris, and Cal Sheely produce our show, and they're great. Our mix is by Noah Smith and James Barber, and they're great too. Steve Nelson is the Vice President of Weekly Content, and he's okay too. And of course, the ultimate bosses, Jessica Cordova Kramer and Stephanie Whittleswax, the executive produced the show, and we love him dearly. Our theme was composed by Dan Malad and Oliver Hill, with additional music by Ivan Kuriev. You can find out more about our show on social media at Lemonada Media, where you can also get a transcript of the show, and you can find me at Ace Lavitt on Twitter. If you like what you heard today, why don't you tell your friends to listen as well and get them to write a review. Thanks so much. Talk to you next time.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere, and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people, and we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Last Day from Lemonada Media explores the moments that change us. Those times where you look back and say, whoa, one day I was myself and the next I wasn't. I'm Stephanie Whittleswax, and I have seen time and time again how sharing these stories can change lives. So, do you have a moment in your life that changed you fundamentally and forever? What happened? How did you move through it? And how did you eventually start again? If you'd like to share your story, go to bit.ly/lastdaystories, bit.ly/lastdaystories. We can't wait to hear from you.